Now, Stephen Campbell Moore continues to read Chopin, Prince of the Romantics by Adam Zamoyski. Tired with the provincialism of his native Poland, the young Chopin arrives in Bohemian Paris, where he plans to make his name.
Paris that Chopin saw for the first time in 1831 was a formidable city. Its size, the grandeur of its buildings, the scale of its open spaces, its bustle and vitality, not to mention its emblems of modernity, such as gas lighting, made Vienna look like a market town by comparison. But Paris was far more than that. Paris is the capital of the entire civilized world. It is the rendezvous of its intellectual notables, wrote the German poet Heinrich Heine. Yet Chopin was no intellectual. What arrested his attention first was the permissive atmosphere which both shocked and delighted him. Apart from the bright lights, he was intrigued by the whores who pursued him in the street, the chorus of girls who were so keen on duets, as he coyly put it. Here you have the greatest luxury, the greatest squalor, the greatest virtue, and the greatest vice. And the nice thing is that nobody cares what anyone else does, he wrote to a friend in Vienna. Paris also boasted the finest collection of performing musicians. The three orchestras were probably the best in Europe. When he went to performances of Rossini's operas under the baton of the composer himself, Chopin felt he was hearing completely different works from those he had heard in Warsaw. Chopin also quickly became aware that Paris lay at the epicenter of European dissidents. There was continuing unrest, fueled by the influx of defeated revolutionaries from Italy, Germany, and Poland. While he was conservative by instinct, the shock of seeing his country crushed had induced a sense of rebellion in him, and he attended meetings along with other Polish émigrés. From September 1831 on, a stream of defeated insurgents began to arrive in the city, and Chopin was reunited with his conservatoire colleague, Antoni Orlovsky. He also became good friends with the German pianist and composer Ferdinand Hiller. A kind of amitié amoureuse sprang up between them. Hiller was fascinated by the figure of Chopin, as supple as a snake and full of charm and movements, and helped Chopin find his bearings. And it was he who introduced him to Felix Mendelssohn, who arrived in December en route for England. Chopin's Parisian debut took place on the 26th of February, 1832, in the Salle Pleyel. The programme included Beethoven's Quintet, Opus 29, played by some of the best musicians in the city. Chopin played his E minor concerto as a solo and his Mozart variations, and he concluded with a monstrous polonaise for six pianos. "Our dear Fritz has given a concert which brought him great reputation," Orlovsky wrote home to his family. "He has wiped the floor with all the pianists here. All Paris is stupefied." In May, Chopin took part in a charity concert at the Conservatoire Hall, but the joy of being able to perform his E minor concerto with the best orchestra in Europe was diminished by the fact that his soft playing was drowned out by it. The Revue Musicale's critic could not hear the piano part and thought the orchestration poor. Chopin was by now well aware that his manner of playing was not suited to large halls, and this sat well with his dislike of large audiences. "I am not fit to give concerts," he told his new friend, Liszt. "The crowd intimidates me, and I feel asphyxiated by its eager breath, silenced by its alien faces, but you are made for it." The fiery extrovert Liszt had little in common with the reserved, delicate, and fastidious Chopin. But Chopin was impressed by his virtuosity, his ability to draw sound out of the piano like no one else. It was Liszt who introduced Chopin to the German poet Heinrich Heine and the French romantic composer Hector Berlioz. Chopin now found himself in the kitchen of the romantic movement, where talents worked together like so many scullions, helping each other out in various ways, When Berlioz needed a piano arrangement for his Franjouge overture, it was Chopin who helped him. The group would meet for dinner in a restaurant, for an evening of music at Chopin's, or at Liszt's, for hours of smoky discussions as they puffed at Turkish pipes. They could hardly have agreed on anything. Liszt had no great fondness for Bach's work, yet Chopin thought it was the essence of music. The others had little time for Mozart or Haydn, Chopin's favourite composers, and they saw Beethoven as the great one, the man who had started the Romantic Revolution and liberated music from its shackles. The differences of opinion went deeper than liking or disliking each other's compositions and had more to do with how these young men saw themselves. The Romantic movement was a revolution against the 18th century role of the artist as an artisan. The artist had now come to be regarded as a seer, who had the divine gift of understanding and interpreting the world of those who no longer believed in the God of the Bible. The movement, which in music began with Beethoven, was now to make a new position for music at the apex of the arts, and for the musician as the quintessential artist, and therefore inherently divine. But Chopin did not fit easily into the Romantic movement. He saw himself more as a craftsman than an artist, and his instinctive reticence shied away from the arrogance implicit in the modern artist's role. He could never take himself seriously enough to see himself as having a mission. Chopin nevertheless feasted on all the musical riches Paris had to offer. He made up his mind to spend at least 3 years in the city. As he wrote to a friend, "One breathes sweetly here." If I had a friend with a big crooked nose, who several years ago had played with me in Chafania, if he, having left the country, had not written a word to me, I should never forgive him, was how Chopin opened a long put-off letter to his old school friend Dominique Chevanovsky. The rest of the letter decidedly gainsays the penitent tone. But I shall try not to make excuses. I have made an entry into the highest society. I sit next to ambassadors, ministers, princes, and I really don't know how it happened because I didn't push myself. People with great reputations dedicate their works to me before I have similarly honoured them. Pupils of the conservatoire and accomplished artists take lessons from me. But I've been boasting like a child. If you do remember me, you'll see that I haven't changed much, with the exception that I have one side whisker. The other won't, simply won't, grow. Today, I have to give 5 lessons. You may think I'll make a fortune, but a cabriolet and white gloves cost more, and without them, you wouldn't have ton. I'm a revolutionary myself, so I don't take any notice of money, only friendship, for the which I beg you. Chopin was now sure of himself and his future, and by 1833 was considered one of the brightest stars of the Paris firmament. His piano playing had developed greatly, and was now quite unlike any others. The first thing that struck people was the elegance and control he displayed. There was no apparent exertion, no exaggerated movement, his fingers moving quite effortlessly over the keys. He could play rapid trills or legato like nobody else, producing, as Hiller put it, the flight of a swallow. Combined with a look of harmonious concentration on face, no knitted brows or passion, he always gave the impression that what he was playing was spontaneous creation, whether an improvisation or a written work. The idea of spontaneity fascinated the Romantics, and Chopin's strongly developed gift for improvisation held people spellbound, not merely by the beauty of the music, but by the consciousness of something extraordinary taking place. This surely was communion with the gods, and fitted perfectly with the Romantic vision of the artist's place within the scheme of things. The poet Hyacinthe Delatouche always spoke of Chopin as that pallid Pole who holds the heavens open. Thank you. This all gave Chopin an enormous advantage in Parisian society. Before the July Revolution of 1830, musicians, even such as Liszt or Rossini, were generally let in by the back door, listened to, and then sent out to be paid by the butler. After 1830, these agents of divinity could no longer be treated as tradesmen. This also meant that Chopin had no shortage of pupils who would pay high fees for lessons. As his financial situation improved, Chopin moved into an elegant apartment on the Rue de la Chaussée d'Antin. He dressed at the best tailors, bought expensive furniture, drove everywhere in a hired cabriolet, and he spent a great deal of money filling his rooms with flowers. "Chopin is well and strong," wrote Antony Orlovsky. "He is turning the heads of ladies and making husbands jealous. He is in fashion. Soon we shall all be wearing gloves à la Chopin." Chopin did not give a single concert in the 1833-34 season. Paradoxically, this was a mark of his success. He no longer needed to perform. He disliked the tyranny of the concert form. He loved playing to people, but he liked to do it in an atmosphere of free association, as though a group of like-minded friends had come together. But his works sold and were played. The nocturnes, waltzes, and mazurkas were ideally suited to the home or the small gathering, which were now dominated by the piano, thanks to the rapid technical development of the instrument. Throughout Europe, the rise of the middle class led to the piano being turned into a kind of household altar at which culture was worshipped. And where there was a piano, there were scores of Chopin's music. When in the spring of 1834, Hiller suggested that Chopin accompany him to the Lower Rhine Music Festival, organized in part by Mendelssohn at Aachen, he agreed. Mendelssohn was overjoyed to see them. "They have both developed their technique," he wrote to his family, "and Chopin is now, as a pianist, one of the very best. He astonishes one with novelties like Paganini on the violin, and introduces such wonderful things that one would have thought impossible." At the same time, he complained that they both suffer a little from the Parisian love of despair and emotional exaggeration, too often losing sight of time and sobriety and of true musical thought. He confessed to feeling like an old schoolmaster faced by a couple of dandies. At the end of May, Chopin and Hiller took a steamer up the Rhine and on up to Koblenz. "Today I feel like the steam from our boat," Chopin wrote to Hiller's mother. "I evaporate into the air and feel one half of me wafting off towards my country and my people, the other towards Paris and you." A few days later, he followed the second half back to Paris.
Stephen Campbell Moore reading Chopin, Prince of the Romantics by Adam Zamoyski. It was abridged by Doreen Estall and produced by Justine Willett. Tomorrow, the now celebrated Chopin meets the most notorious woman of her day.
For 1942's greatest picture, the famous Mrs. Miniver.
For BBC Radio 4, Paul Gambaccini hears the stories behind Academy Award-winning pictures.
He did not feel burdened by the need to make a balanced movie. Mrs. Miniver obviously was a propaganda film.
I think they felt that going to see it was a patriotic duty.
Now you're ready for real flying.
Oh, not only for real flying, but real... well, whatever they send me into.
Fighting.
And the Academy Award goes to... over on BBC Radio 4 on Saturday morning at 10:30.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock now, this is the Drama Hour with Kathy Clugston, the idiot. Oh, sorry, the idiot is next. Then Mel Gedroych wishes Gemma Arterton a happy birthday, and Tony Robinson picks his two top books in the 4 o'clock show. Later tonight, we have the true story of a 16-year-old girl forced to flee Berlin in 1934. Edith's story by Robin Glendinning is at 9:15. So let's continue Dostoevsky's tale of a good man in a morally corrupt and unfeeling world. The Idiot was first published in the late 19th century. Prince Mishkin has returned to Russia after several years in Switzerland being treated for epilepsy. His illness was so severe that he was labelled almost an idiot. He's now reacquainting himself with his homeland and any remaining family members. And he'd like to better acquaint himself with Natasha, despite the dark tales he's heard about her. So he's off to her birthday party.
The Idiot by Dostoevsky. Dramatised for radio in 4 episodes by Melissa Murray. With Paul Rees as Prince Mishkin, Alex Jennings as Ganya, Roger Allam as Rogozhin, Leah Williams as Nastasya, David Swift as General Yapanchin, Paula Jacobs as Mrs. Yapanchin, and Stephen Moore as General Ivolgin. Episode